Hello to our loyal listeners, and welcome back to another episode of Mise en Scène with Xavier and Alan. As always, we'll be looking at all manner of film and theatre from around the world. Now, remember to like, follow, or subscribe to our show on your favourite listening platform, and also check us out and follow us on Facebook or Instagram to get sneak peeks at upcoming episodes and some bonus content. This week, we're heading back to India and the world of Tamil language cinema to look at a four-part anthology film titled Parvakadahil. So, hello, and take it away, Alan.
Hello, Saban. Of course, hello to our favorite fans. Welcome back to Mise en Scène. And before we reach for our box of tissues and delve into Honor Killings, I want to make our usual disclaimer that our podcasts are best saved for those who have seen the film prior. And as always, spoiler warnings ahead. So this week, we're looking at Parvakadahil, as Dave said, which is a 2020 South Indian anthology series streaming on Netflix. To give our listeners a quick brief, we will summarize the plot of each episode before breaking it down. So the first episode is called Thangam, which translates to Golden. This episode was directed by Sudha Kongara. It's about Sathar, played by Kalidas Jayaram, and he's the local trans villager who has for a long time been ostracized and subjected to bullying by the local villagers and thugs. He risks everything to support the dream of his beloved childhood friend, Saravana, played by Sathana Bhagiraj. Now, Saravana seems like the only person in the village who treats Sathar as a human being and not just an abomination of society. They've grown up as close friends, but it seems that Sathar has developed a deeper romantic feelings, but is hesitant to tell him. Saravana at one point discloses that he's in love with his sister, Syra, played by Bhavani Sri. And the episode picks up with the clashing between Syra's and Saravana's parents not accepting their relationship due to being from different religious backgrounds. So, say, what did you think of this episode?
I thought this was actually a fascinating little look at not just sexual identities, but also that of sort of religious prejudices and sort of social upbringing and castes and whatnot of people. And when I first saw it, I deliberately had gone into watching this anthology, mind you, having not read anything about each episode and not even reading the synopsis. I wanted to be surprised as to what the content actually lay in store. And I certainly didn't expect the first one to necessarily be about a trans character. So when I started watching it, I thought the main character comes across as somewhat entitled, and he's quite arrogant in his own sort of way, and that's juxtaposed by the town that sort of push back actively against him. He's the outcast, he's the strange one, there's clearly perceived to be something wrong with him. And I guess this is, to a greater extent, talking about the issues that a lot of trans people may face in a whole raft of cultures, not strictly just in that of India. And the film sort of attempted, to some degree, in my viewing, to normalize transgender people by somewhat implying that there's something wrong with everyone else for not accepting them and why they don't accept them. Because I think it sort of went past just being a straight up bigotry thing and saying, no, there's underlying social values and historical context that sort of suggest this is a significant issue for reasons of, you know, tradition and honor and whatnot. And it takes it one step further to go, this doesn't just apply to transgendered people, but even, as you said, his friend and his sister wanting to be together, they're from different religious backgrounds. And so with very similar results, they're also punished, ostracized, forced out of town, because both Saravana and Sathar were essentially threatened with being killed if either of them continued to live the lives at which they wanted. Now, Saravana fortunately had the opportunity to escape, largely with the assistance of Sathar, by giving him all of his money that he'd previously put aside and been saving for his own gender reassignment surgery. And that allowed Saravana and his sister to escape and essentially survive, whereas Sathar didn't, because the town people essentially punished him for essentially what was deemed his crimes and also those of his friend and his sister. So, and I think the film sort of served to highlight the sort of pious position that minorities can demand and hold over society in general, as we sort of saw, you know, potentially for transgender minorities. But I think by the same token, it was, as I said, having a real look at how a whole bunch of these ingrained social beliefs can actually have huge ramifications on a vast array of people, not just about sexuality. How about you?
Yeah, so I found this episode really interesting, as it explores more than one concept that's not often explored in much or in this much depth in South Indian cinema. We know that all four anthologies have the underlying theme of caste and honor killings, but this first episode added the elements of the lead protagonist being, as you mentioned, a trans male, along with the narrative driver being religiously motivated. The tensions between accepting Hindu-Muslim marriages in film have been explored previously, but when you place it in the melting pot of all these uncommonly discussed themes, and if it's done correctly, as Sudha Kongara has done, it elevates viewing experience from your standard masala film. Now, by being more narrative driven and reducing the panache, you know, that we're used to seeing, it makes us hone in on the characters and engage in the storytelling. And that's exactly what I felt when I'm watching this film. I was engaged with Sathar's emotions, realizing the pain of being an outcast, and not only in society, but with your own family. Sathar's anguish for just wanting to be accepted and being able to live his life the way he wants to on his own terms. The pain of Saravana's subjected to when he comes back to the village after eloping and realizing his best friend is no longer alive. And the sole reason for that demise of Sathar are the very people who have supposedly forgiven him and Saira and allowed him to return. I think this was a great juxtaposition in irony.
It really was. And as I said before, it was almost like Sathar ultimately paid the penance for both his friend and sister, as well as his own perceived misgivings in terms of being a transgender person. And I also wondered too, if it was sort of taking a deeper look, sort of beyond this surface level, you know, everybody should be treated equally, and sort of saying, you know, Sathar, to a large extent, was confused as to why he didn't fit in society. And that was very clear in the film. He was vastly different, and he knew he was, but he was quite confident in the fact that he was different, and that was okay. But I think at the same time as he had that confusion and didn't fit in, there was almost this element of the fact that, well, maybe he shouldn't fit in because he doesn't fit society's norms and ideals and their sort of social beliefs and cultural heritage and all these sorts of things that it sort of explored at some depth in the film. And it was almost like saying, well, you know, you're the aberration, you're the outlier of what's considered normal, so you should feel that way because you're not the same. But I don't think it was saying that that was necessarily a bad thing. I think a large part of that was saying, you know, people on all sides need to adapt. The people that deem it abnormal need to adapt over time and ultimately believe that, you know, it could be an accepted thing. But likewise, the people that are currently the perceived outliers or the aberrations of normal also need to accept that it's going to be a struggle for some people. So they will need to be seen as different for a while until such time as everybody comes to the table. And I think the really important thing out of all of it, though, was that Sathar had an ally, and it was his friend. And, you know, it showed that there was this true power of honor and friendship, and that he respected Sathar as an individual, despite any perceived proclivities that he may have had. They were friends, and for that reason, he accepted him for who he was and what he did, and it didn't matter about the rest, because it was about the value of the person as an individual, not about their personal preferences, be it sexual, religious, or otherwise.
It's interesting that you mention about how Sathar fits into society, because, you know, he's so confident that he doesn't even belong in this community. He like, as a viewer, you feel like he may even thrive in another country under a different environment who accepts him. The relationship that you talk about, him and his friends, it's such a beautiful relationship. He doesn't see any of his sexual orientation as a flaw. He sees him for himself as a person, as a human being, as we all should. But the people around him are constantly poisoning his thoughts. Even his father at the shop saying, look, I don't even care if you're seeing a whore. I just don't want the community to think that you're sleeping with this she-man. And, you know, like, that to him is such a, you know, like, a whore is so much better than this person. And it's crazy how that's how this society interprets these people. One scene that I wanted to discuss with you is the tragic scene of him pleading to be saved before Sathar is potentially raped and killed by these local thugs. What were your thoughts on this scene?
I took this scene from a slightly different perspective because I didn't want to take it at face value. I wanted to see if there was some sort of underlying message in here, because a lot of this story, I think, was about what wasn't on the surface. And I do wonder if the scene where Sathar is being chased is more about the perceived harm that trans people can inflict upon society and those closest to them more than anything else, in terms of, you know, the perceived dishonor that they may bring to a family and the knock-on effect that can have in societies. And I believe this was largely a commentary about the suffering of others as a result of the choices that other people may make, whether that's transgender or anything else, because, as we said, you know, his sister and friend ran away and eloped. And it's about that more than the suffering of transgender people necessarily in that instance. Now, certainly while, you know, he was raped and murdered, yes, that was about him. It wasn't done specifically to him because he was who he was. It was because society on the whole, his father and whatnot, had sort of said, no, this must be done because we don't want these type of people. It wasn't just, we don't want Sathar as an individual. So I thought it might have been sort of saying that the choices of others don't solely impact on them, as some people might have us believe, because it almost felt like they attempted to use his friend Saravanan as a character to cast shame upon the perceived normal people for the things that they had done. And I did wonder if it was actually trying to sort of show the effects on society for the choices we make, rather than just at an individualistic, idealistic level.
Yeah, look, I think it's interesting because Kongra described that when filming the scene, she gave full rein to Jairam to work his magic. The snot and the drool was all real, and a real testament to the intensity portrayed by Jairam as an actor. The dissonance between mainstream society's acceptance and the LGBTQI community is painfully articulated in this scene. There's a great article by Rebecca Clay titled "Decriminalizing Homosexuality in India," and she alludes that up until the 19th century, homosexuality was illegal and the treatment against it was conversion therapy. She describes that parents often push their gay and lesbian children into treatment, asking that they may be, you know, may be made straight. The fear of losing families and social status was such a strong that they themselves would say, you know, I just want to get out of this.
It's worth pointing out, too, that that wasn't exclusively a treatment in terms of conversion therapy carried out in India. I believe it was carried out in countries such as Australia as late as the 1930s or 40s. Don't quote me on that, but I do have this vague inkling that I've read something about that, too.
Yeah.
But I would like to mention, too, that I think particularly in this story, it is very agenda, not particularly subtle in what it's trying to convey. It is very definitely sort of trying to say, here's an issue that's being faced, particularly in Indian society, in this case of this little film, and, you know, pay attention to what's happening. Here's why it's happening, and here's often the ramifications that people are being faced as a result of it.
Yeah, I think it's bold in the attempt to discuss taboo topics, and using Netflix as a medium of distribution sort of adds weight to allowing the content to reach the global audience and not just pertaining to nationally in India. And there's a couple of lines in the song lyrics, "What's wrong with the way I'm born? Am I to blame for that?" That's, I think, we hear at the very end of the episode, which just summates everything that episode's trying to convey. So on that note, let's move on to the second episode, say. The second episode is titled La Panna Utrama, which means Let's Let the Lovers Be, which is directed by Vignesh Shivan. And Netflix describes the plot as, fearing their father's staunch views on marriage, two sisters take separate approaches to tell him who they love, with wildly different outcomes. So, Saeed, give me your thoughts on this episode.
This episode, in terms of being heavy in content like the first one, took on a very different approach. And right from the outset, you're sort of led to believe that it might be about lesbians. Ultimately, it turns out not to be that. But I think really the core message from this, and this is right from the outset, is that it's the hypocrisy of those who preach equality but don't actually practice it in reality. You know, there's that disconnect between what public perception is of individuals and what they're actually like behind closed doors. And this is particularly clear between the father, the daughter, and the driver. And I think it goes one step further too to say this isn't just about an individualistic perspective, but it's also about religious zealotry. And this is a theme not just unique to India. Again, a lot of these issues are faced around the world. Now, there were a few elements in this film where, you know, I did wonder if it was sort of playing off again, as a bit like I alluded to in the transgender first film, where there's almost an arrogance or an entitlement of minority groups to think that they can do as they want in societies that may not necessarily be particularly accepting of them. And to another extent, I did wonder if that was maybe also having a shot across the bow at foreigners who feel like they can come into other cultures and impress their views upon different societies and beliefs. And for me, that was very much through the character of the white female that we were originally led to believe may have been the lover of the daughter of the preacher who, you know, turned out to be the father that they feared. And therefore that, you know, not everyone should have to accept equally because not everyone necessarily has the same views, irrespective of whether they're within the same culture or they're from outside of a given culture. Maybe it was a little bit of a cliche around different cultures and beliefs, particularly those of Western perceptions on Eastern beliefs. But I think on the whole, it was quite an interesting look, essentially, as I said, about those who preach something versus those who actually practice it.
Exactly. The episode for me opens up with the quote from a renowned Tamil philosopher, Anvayar, and it's spoken by Kalki, which is played by Penelope. The quote expresses the existence of two castes alone, based on moral principles and impartiality. It denies the authority of every other existing caste. And I think that was a brilliant, powerful way to start the episode. This was such a crucial moment as, you know, it sets the scene for what we're about to see. However, the narrative sort of deviates from this core notion at times. And Saeed, I think our thoughts are parallel on the hypocrisy of Vera Simmons, played by Padam Kumar. even though the people are led to believe he's sort of an influential leader advocating for social equality by conducting these intercaste marriages, you know, this is not how he really feels. And at least that's what we're led to believe. It's only later that we realize that he's influenced by other people and he doesn't really have his own opinion. Now, one scene that really dilutes the tensions of the narrative is where the minion confuses the word lesbians with ESPN. I appreciated the comic relief, but I think it sort of, you know, it took away slightly from the narrative for me personally.
I think you're right. And this was one of the issues I did have with the story. We'll come to a little bit of my gripe with it a little bit later on. But it did have these little sort of comic relief moments. And at one level, I sort of went, okay, I don't know if that really works. It just felt a little bit forced. But on the other hand, I thought it wasn't necessarily comic relief. It was the ultimate form of patronizing. And I think if you took it at that level, it really was effective because it was devaluing someone to the point where you wouldn't even say the word. You'll make a mockery out of something that they may identify as. And so you're not even giving the benefit of saying, let alone insulting. You're just insulting by not saying it. I know that's a little bit sort of back and forth, but I thought it worked quite well in that sense. Comic relief, not so much, because I didn't find it funny. I found it actually quite confronting in a way because you could feel that tension.
Yeah, for sure. The tension was definitely palpable, like when you move towards that pathway. But say, I think it's imperative to discuss the role of Narikuti in the narrative. What were your thoughts about him?
For me, his character, he was quite a creepy little man. Now, that's not just sort of him as an individual. You know, he's a very small statured person, obviously, in reality. But I think the character that he portrayed, it was so much more effective that he was a small individual compared to Virasimhan, because Virasimhan was quite a big, intimidating, physical presence of a person. But Narikuti was vindictive, he was manipulative, and actually towards the end sort of say, you know, he's a venomous serpent essentially from memory. And he really is, because he's the puppet master in the background. He's pulling the strings, he's controlling people. He really is actually the brains behind the whole operation. You know, he essentially has a father murder his own daughter. That's a person with real control over someone. But the main character of Virasimhan wouldn't even notice it. He sort of didn't even perceive or understand the fact that he was being controlled by this other figure. And I think that was a really important thing, because I think if you step this up to be a political commentary at a larger scale, irrespective of what country it is, we often see the figureheads, whether they're presidents, prime ministers, kings, queens, whatever it may be, and whatever your demographic is, we like to believe they are the people in power. But the reality of it is there's almost always someone behind their controlling policy, making policy, writing policy, dictating policy, or standing in the way of something going through, be it legislation or whatnot. We like to think, as perhaps democratic society, that that's not always the case, that we all get a say. But you have to remember that behind even the likes of a senate or a council or even a board of a company, that there will always be people with agendas, that there will always be something going on in the background, and that often those agendas and those people's motivations come to the fore irrespective of what's actually seen. And as we say, Virasimhan on the outside is very much a person that seems to be coming to terms with sort of intercaste marriages and he's okay with it, until the point at which it actually affects him personally. But again, he's controlled by someone else and led to believe that no, this is all terrible. So I think it was really a very fascinating look at who actually has the power in any dynamic, and that it's not always a person we see at the front.
Yeah, look, I think that's a brilliant take on this. I didn't see the political angle, but now that you mention it, it's quite clear. And for me, I believe that he was the embodiment or a personification of Virasimhan's own inner battles and his own sort of inner dark thoughts. Narikuti is, you know, he's the clear antagonist of the episode, and he's constantly in the ear of his master, sort of swaying his thoughts and invoking the cowardice in him, and he dilutes the voice of reason in him.
And I think it's interesting that you actually mentioned that he's almost that embodiment or personification of him, because I believe, and this may not be true for everyone, but I do believe that in order for someone to be swayed a certain way, at least some part of them must already feel that way.
Yeah.
I think if nobody has that belief at all, then it's very difficult to get purchase in someone to go against what they believe is morally or obligatory wrong or right, as the case may be. So I think you're right. Her father did very much have these feelings, and he may have outwardly been trying to change. He may have actually wanted to be a different person, but he still held some of these darker thoughts within himself, and therefore he was more readily manipulated.
Yeah. So, Seb, you mentioned that you had some gripes with this episode. What were they?
My biggest gripe with this was actually the ending. I hated the ending of this thing, and I think it totally ruined the entire film. Yeah. So, yeah, essentially, we're led to believe throughout the whole film that, you know, one of the couples is lesbians. But it ultimately turns out that the daughter is actually in love with B-Cube, who's a complete idiot. And for me, it completely undermined the moral of the story for me, because he was a terrible character in the first place. And I imagine most fathers and even mothers wouldn't want their daughter with such an imbecile in the first place, irrespective of what culture you're in. And I think it had less to do with caste, race, or sex in the end, and simply the fact that his daughter was in love with a moron. And for me, that really undermined the whole moral story of this, because it ceased to be about a father just not wanting her to be, you know, lesbian, something that was a deeper issue. And it just sort of became, oh, like, you're marrying that total dimwit? And so for me, it really lost the plot there.
Yeah, I think you've taken the words out of my mouth, Sam. The over-stereotyping of a rapper was just distasteful. Look, there are rappers who do fit into the tropes that could have added value to the movie, but the B-Cube angle was completely pointless. Instead, they could have focused on the relationship and the dynamic of the three friends and how the situation sort of affected their relationship. But all in all, I completely agree. I think the ending should have been a little bit more on par with what the initial first line of the movie was, which is that Avayar quote. Because to open a movie with that powerful quote and then to sort of dilute it down to sort of a comedic relief, I think Santosh Shivan should have taken a different angle. And, you know, it's not saying that everything was bad, but it's something that he has to consider moving forward.
But I think this is the thing, because in this story, we see that the father already murders one daughter, and we go through the funeral and the grieving and all these sorts of things and the threats from the father to say, you know, you get one chance to live. If you don't leave now, I'll kill you. And then the film tries to have this clever ending, but with a less powerful meaning than the original intent. And I think the writers lacked the conviction of their own story to give us more than they already had. Instead, they opted for this weaker, ha-ha, made you look type of ending, which ultimately let the whole film down, because while we've just seen a film, and these are half-hour episodes, so we're not talking about a long-winded story where we've forgotten what happened 10 minutes ago. This is a film where a daughter was essentially brutally murdered. She was electrocuted in the bath out of honor, but it ends with four idiots driving away in a car laughing like a bunch of dickheads. And I'm like, nah, you've screwed the pooch for me here.
Yeah. So there's even horrific cases of what's called a corrective rape, in which lesbians are raped by men with the intention of turning them into heterosexuals. And, you know, this is something that Kanika Kay, a PhD associate professor of psychology at the Lady Sri Rams College of the University of Delhi sort of says. And I think this, it's crazy, because this is a strong aspect of the psyche of this particular community. And, you know, I can only imagine all the difficulties that the LGBTQTI people have to sort of like traverse just to be seen as normal.
And I think given this film and all of the films in this anthology are dealing with such heavy content and subsequently the ramifications of such, be it, again, you know, racial, sexual backgrounds, honour, whatnot. For me, and I didn't know about this corrective rape thing, but having just heard it now, for me, as distasteful as it sounds, I would have rather that to have been the conclusion for the daughter and her perceived lesbian friend, because I feel like that would have been far more powerful in saying this is just another aspect of society which has massive consequences that are profound, and they don't just affect locals, that if you bring someone else into this, they will be caught up. And the father giving her that one opportunity to escape, if they had utilized that and she'd gone, no, I'm going to save the woman I love, your daughter, and the consequence of that was corrective rape or murder, I think it would have been that much more powerful, because it would have had this follow through, as you said, from what we were led to believe right at the start, and not four people running away laughing. Like, I just
exactly. It and him rapping at the end, just it completely just dilutes everything and the intensity of the scene and the intensity of the whole episode, to be honest. So it was a little bit of a letdown. Moving on to episode 3, and this is the third episode, which is titled Vanmangal, which means a daughter of the sky. It's directed by Gautam Vasudevanan, oftenly and fondly referred to as GVM. It's about parents trying to cope with the post-traumatic situation when the young daughter is raped. So, Saif, what did you think about this film?
This was my favorite of the four little films or episodes in this anthology. And I really liked it because it had a massive juxtaposition. So right at the start, it immediately had a nicer feel than the others. It wasn't going for dark and gritty and, you know, awful circumstances where you could feel something ominous was coming. Even if you knew it was because of the context of the film, it had a nice beginning. And I feel like as a result of that, it didn't feel like it was immediately trying to shove some sort of politically correct agenda down my throat, because I sort of went, okay, you've invited me into the story. Now let's see where you're actually going to take me. And I found that it showed respect towards women and it honors them as they come of age. And that was very different to the previous two episodes. And I did make a point of watching the four of these back to back, so you got that juxtaposition within each episode as well.
Yeah.
But at the same time as it showed this respect and honor of women, you then had rape and pedophilia thrown in there that shows this harsh juxtaposition of women's virtuous standing within Indian culture against the celebration of it. Where on the one hand, they're celebrated, that celebration inherently means they're also ripe for the taking, be it unwilling or not. And I think that was a very, very powerful thing in this, because all of these films to some degree deal with the value of women in this particular culture. And unlike the first two films, this is a tale of decency and respect at the highest level, and the duty of all to respect women and the strength of parents to protect their children. And on the whole, I believe that's a message that any society anywhere on earth can understand and appreciate. And while you may not necessarily be faced with the same issues, these issues in terms of rape and pedophilia do crop up throughout the world. And while you hope it never happens to your family, to some extent you do watch this film and go, yes, as a parent, how would I deal with it? As a sibling of a raped child, how would I deal with it? And for me, this film executed that brilliantly. How about you?
Yeah, so even though it started off feeling less intense compared to the other three stories, this episode was a real stomach churner. It was so simplistically portrayed that the nuances in each character's emotions really reverberated the soul. This episode explores the resolute beliefs of what it means to be innocent and pure, while also juxtaposing the effects of what happens when such an image is tarnished according to society's standards. It unveils the social, personal, and emotional intricacies that matriarchs have to endure in a captured society.
For sure. And I think further to what you sort of said in terms of the portrayal of the nuances of the characters' emotions, in my opinion, the acting in this episode was brilliant. Like it was truly excellent. And some of the best acting I've sort of seen, certainly in the anthology and certainly of late in some of the Tamil cinema that we've done. And for me, you really felt a mother's love. You felt a daughter's fear. You felt a father's duty and a son's obligation. And for me, the power that came in that, as you said, through the delivery of these characters, particularly between the father and the son, because the first two films had been essentially about men's mistreatment of mothers, wives, daughters, and whatnot. And in this one, it was a father coming to terms with how he could look at his daughter again after she'd been essentially defiled, and how he could still see her as his beautiful thing. And in the start of this film, you feel very much like, oh no, it's going to be another one where he casts out his daughter because of shame and all this sort of thing. But while it had those tones, it ultimately became about a father's acceptance that no matter what, his love for his daughter is the strongest thing. And that's at complete odds with the film that we just mentioned as number two. But I think we also got a sense of satisfaction because there was the son's perceived obligation in the fact that he should have protected his sister, that he should have been there for her, that he should have saved her, that he should have somehow prevented this from happening. And I think most people watching this at some primitive or primeval level, I certainly found this satisfying, was that when he actually hunted down the person, someone he knew who had raped his younger sister, he and his friends banded together, caught the culprit, and cut his penis off. And I think that was very satisfying because it was a justice that went beyond sort of social constructs in terms of call the police and go through due diligence and whatnot. This was very much about honor still, but it was about a son honoring his sister and her dignity as a young girl. And for me, that was very, very powerful. And I don't have sisters myself, but I still felt this. And I think anyone that does have sisters, I would dare not to feel like they would want to do the same thing if their preteen sister was raped and violated.
Yeah, I think we're definitely in accord to say Simran's performance as a mother is just truly exceptional. She's able to inhabit the persona of a mother who's sort of furious, yet still in disbelief of what's occurred. Her concerns are exhibited, you know, with her, like, bathing her daughter ferociously and then embracing her ferociously. You know, it's that dichotomy of that, you know, cleaning and embracing and cleaning and embracing, only to break down in hysterics in another adjacent scene as the magnitude of what's transpired becomes unsavoringly obvious to her. I think she starts to realize what the truth is, and no amount of bathing or cleaning is going to take away or wash away the horrors that her daughter and her family have felt.
For sure, for sure. And that scene where she essentially washes or bathes her daughter again the next morning when the bruising has become apparent, you really felt a shift in her character as the mother, because it became almost like, now I can see the violation of my daughter and I have to wash it off her. And in that moment, I thought, it's the mother that's going to lose the plot here. The mother can no longer accept her daughter, that she's now violated. She's unclean. She's been abused in this way that I can't fix as a mother. I can't take this back. And that wash almost became violent in a way, to the point where she was almost hurting the child because she was so intent that she had to wash away this blight upon her daughter, but that she couldn't. And it did raise a question for me towards the end of the film where I wondered, did the mother actually kill the daughter? In the sense of, we see her push her off the cliff and she's splattered on the path down below. Now, the film continues on for a little bit beyond that, and you see a scene where the daughter isn't there and you see a scene where the daughter is there. Now, my perception of this was that, yes, she did kill her daughter. And the reason I say that is because there's a scene where she's lying in the bed, and usually the daughters and the mother share the bed, and there's only one daughter in the bed, and she's sort of lying awake looking at her other daughter's possessions, and there's, you know, images of like an astronaut and whatnot. Obviously the daughter had a penchant for space. But then you see the following scene to that is the mother sitting on a bench with her daughter lying next to her with her head on her lap. And so you go, oh, maybe she's not. But you have this voiceover that mentions her daughter flying in space and that she's somewhere else. And I did wonder if this was actually her inner psyche, that her daughter was with her. She was always present, and that she would always love her and essentially regret what she's done, and that she would need to meet her daughter again in that other world, that ethereal plane, to beg forgiveness for what she's done, but that for now she had done what she did and that she did in fact kill her in reality. Right. But that was just my perception of it.
Yeah, well, look, your perception of the ending is absolutely brilliant, man. I didn't see it like that, but it's something that definitely has provoked me to sort of go back and watch that ending again. But, like, I think the film does highlight the unpalatable notion of victim blaming or shaming that is often cognizant among a rape culture.
Mm.
The Sydney Morning Herald sort of states that there are regressive attitudes towards women rooted in India's sort of deep traditions and conservative culture, in which women embody a family or a community's izzat or honor. And this is something that we've already talked about before. And the clothes they wear and where they go and what time and with whom, and, you know, it must be controlled lest they bring dishonor and disgrace through, you know, unacceptable behavior such as, you know, being seen with a man who's not a relative, or smoking or drinking or dancing or wearing revealing clothes, or just being out after the dark. And, you know, it's very ingrained and institutionalized in the culture.
Something else that drives this home too is the fact that they don't call the police. They're a bit on the fence. Part of them wants to call the police, the other half of them doesn't want to call the police. And they're worried about this sort of taboo and dishonor, as you mentioned, that, you know, having a daughter that's been raped, it's victim blaming. She's the dirty one, will be looked down upon, and all this sort of attitude. And that really is an important thing that the film is going for here, because it very much is about, I guess, the victim in a way, and how the family will be perceived as a result of their unclean daughter, and not the fact that something terrible was done to them. And it goes to the extent where even some of the mother's friends come and go, why hasn't your daughter been at school? You know, they're hiding her away. And obviously rumors gotten around that her daughter's raped, but the mother won't confirm this. You know, she will not let the people in, because you can even tell on screen that the attitude of them isn't one of concern for the daughter or concern for the mother. It's very much a case of, is your daughter unclean? Is there something wrong with you now? Should we no longer be associated with you? And I think that speaks to a systemic and very concerning issue that even the women themselves, in and amongst themselves, accept it as normal and acceptable in a way, to actually shun and tarnish each other, including their daughters, which could very well happen to their own daughters because of something that was done to them by someone else. And I think that's troubling. And I do think that was an important element this film was going for.
Yeah, of course. Like, I think there is that existing notion of bias and stigma, and a stigma caused by society's, you know, a perception of women and the standards that they have to uphold. And I guess that's sort of, you know, like, you're absolutely right. That's definitely what this, at the end of this film, is sort of like alluding to. So to answer your question, is the daughter dead? In my perception, I don't think so. I think she explores the notion of killing her in the name of honor and society. But then she says, for me to even fathom that, it means that I'll be as guilty as those who have subjected us to these same standards. And I think that's what Madhi's final inner monologue argues with. It, like, you know, like she sort of like grapples with this notion that In such a society, a family's honor resides on the shoulders of its own women and the pressures and intricacies associated with that. So I think she's thought about it, but then she's disgusted with herself for even thinking about it.
I can definitely say that way, because I can't deny, part of me did wonder if that was what was going on, and yeah. I sort of went, oh no, maybe I think it was the other way.
But either way, I think GVM's done a brilliant job, and it was one of my favourite episodes in this anthology.
Yeah, for sure. So with that, do you want to tell us about number 4?
Yeah, for sure. Moving on to episode 4. It's Vetrimaran's Ori River, which means One Night. It's the final installment in the anthology and probably the most grim. It's described by Netflix as, estranged from her family after eloping, a now pregnant young woman is brought home by her father, who says he wishes to hold a baby shower for her. So, Save, let's unpack this final episode.
Man, this was dark.
Yeah, this was pretty really bad. Dark.
Look, obviously, like the others, this one deals with honor again, family honor. But for me, more correctly, this was actually dealing with the complete lack of honor there within of the perceived honor system. As with number 3, this was a vastly better episode than the first two. It was a better story, better acting, and a much better social context challenging the norms of life, and not just the arrogance and psychological aberrations of people in that society. If this and number 3 are true stories, as it's actually alluded to towards the end, then these films truly do serve and highlight the deep-seated fundamental issues within some Indian levels of society at a cultural level, because a father that murders his daughter because she's married out of caste and his unborn grandchild in such a horrific way is truly troubling and speaks to a very, very serious systemic issue when people are okay with that. And I think the biggest parallel with this, which wasn't something that occurred in the first episode when the transgender boy's sister and friend ran away and sort of lived a life, but we never saw the life they lived. In this one, we saw that while they had eloped and married and left the family and moved into the city, they had done very well for themselves. The man she married, despite being of a different caste, had looked after her exceptionally well. They had their own apartment. They had their own car. They were very well to do. You know, they had achieved great things. And as a father, even in this sort of patriarchal society, normally you would think that he'd be very proud of a daughter that had managed to actually make such a good choice and do so much with her life. But the knock-on of that was that we saw that it had ultimately resulted in her siblings being banned from going to school because it would make them too clever and they'd also leave. And the father was ultimately disappointed. And while he came under the guise of saying, I'm angry with you, but I still love my grandchild, he had an ulterior motive, which again, like in number 2, where the father murdered his daughter, he was very much driven and manipulated to a certain extent by the people around him and the society he was in. And in this case, it would seem to me it was much more familial ties that drove him to murder his daughter, but equally troubling that a man would murder his daughter as well as unborn child in this case, in the way that he did. And like I said, this was truly dark, but a very, very powerful and very meaningful episode.
Yeah, look, there's no doubt about it, Save. The last two episodes are by far superior than their counterparts. Vetrimaran is a layered director. You know, he's able to bring the genuine nuances of communities, lived experiences onto screen. And the last 10 minutes of this film is just so powerful. As a viewer, you're aching for the hero to come and save the day. But, you know, as we have seen time and time again from mainstream South Indian cinema, but Vetrimaran adopts a more pragmatic approach to storytelling, and you get a raw, unfiltered emotion and narrative that just transcends your expectation of what the ending is going to be, and you're just left with this sort of void after you're watching it. The episode shows how Sai Pallavi, who plays Sumathi, is shunned as a result of marrying from a different caste, and we're showing the effects of her decisions on her loved ones rather than just on herself, like we've seen in the other episodes. Like, her brother is denied a part of his education, her family are ostracized. Where she lives her life in the city, I don't think she's privy to what's happening back home. So she's not even really aware of what her actions have actually caused on her family. So it's almost saying, is this killing justified so the family can go back to normalcy? Because she does have two other sisters to sort of worry about. So I think there is a line there maybe where he goes, you know, I need to get the other two married off.
Well, I believe he actually says that one sister's husband left her. Was it this one? Because of the marriage out of caste, and he didn't want to be associated with such a family.
So, you know, that's what I mean. So it's just like, I think for the father, this is for him coming back to equilibrium. So he's justified it already in his head.
Yeah, he is. And a lot of this film, and particularly in number two, where that creepy little character is actually, you know, he actually talks about it's our job to maintain the balance. You know, there's sort of these two sides of the same coin. One side might promote greater equity and balance and whatnot, but by the same token, you need that counterpart to counteract some of that balance and sort of maintain the status quo. And so I think you were right. You know, the father very much was trying to get his family back into essentially the good graces of society on the whole, so that his daughters could be married off and the family wouldn't be ostracized from the society and people would actually embrace them as part of the community again. And at one level, you sort of look at this from an outside and go, it must actually be very, very tough for a family in those sort of circumstances. And we're not talking about wealthy people, to be cut off from the community like that. But by the same token, you go, well, at what point do you say the ends justifies the means? Yeah. And I think a really powerful line in this was that her father, while she lies there dying and essentially miscarries her baby on the floor, he sort of says that, you know, your uncle didn't tell me that you'd die like this. He said it would be quick if I mixed it with water. And instead she dies a horribly agonizing, painful death in front of him that plays out. And he essentially locks her in a room and stands there and waits, but he won't look her in the eye because he can't face what he's done, but he knows it. And to some extent, I guess he doesn't care, because while he does at one level, he values the freedoms of his family in terms of society's perception at a greater one. And he walks out of the house and says to the uncle, you know, essentially, it's done. And sort of they wash their hands of it and all is well again.
Yeah.
But by the same token, I think the really powerful, important part of the end of this film is actually where we're given some context as to what happened afterwards. And this is what led me to believe that this is actually a true story, because it says that her mother, who was there trying to save her and got locked up by her husband, screaming and yelling to try and save her daughter, she was committed to a psychiatric hospital, I believe, during the court case, because she was deemed, you know, unstable and not a good witness and whatnot. And essentially the father was acquitted of the crime and such was life. And everybody went on and just kind of swept it under the rug. And that's concerning, but unfortunately not particularly uncommon.
Yeah, it's such a so powerful ending and a great way to wrap up a four-part anthology with these underlying themes.
Yeah, so this series deals very heavily with modern issues around sexuality, acceptance, and family honour through a traditional lens. And I mean, each of these films has a little montage with lyrics to truly sell the message at the end of this film, and that's very powerful. And you know, as we've discussed, most of these stories highlight serious issues within particularly an Indian patriarchal society and the norms that it embraces. And it's not just at an individualistic level, as I've discussed, but it's also men oppressing other men in order to maintain the status quo that I mentioned. You know, men convincing fathers to kill their own sons and daughters and that they're okay with this, that it's accepted enough in society that, sure, murder my son, murder my daughter. There's cases where we see a father say to another man, you can go and kill them if you want, if that will make everything better. And it sort of says that honor is important, but at what cost does it come and where do we draw the line for it?
Yeah, as we've seen in the series, there isn't really a singular antagonist in each episode. There is a silent antagonist influencing each character's personal motivations. The underlying tone is almost saying that these honor killings are justified when protecting the notions of your honor, which is completely absurd. And I think that the silent antagonist that's influencing a character is that of society's beliefs. SCMP.com alludes to the fact that honor killings are not just pertinent to India, but it's a global issue. Every year, honor killings make news around the globe. So outcry in Iran over honor killings of a 14-year-old girl, that was in May 2020. Suspected honor killings of a 21-year-old woman sparks Palestine protests, 2019. Newly married Christian man beaten to death in an honor killing that shocks southern India, 2018. A teenager's body found in fridge in suspected London honor killing, 2017. So it's definitely a systemic problem that's probably not very, it hasn't been brought to light in mainstream media, and you know, something that we definitely need to sort of like consider. But finally, Divya Venkatu from Feminism India has expressed her concerns with the heterosexual man playing a trans character. She insists that the need for appropriation and misrepresentation of narratives have to eventually stop.
Now, I think all of these films highlight some major cultural challenges currently being faced, not just by Indian society, but also other deeply historically minded cultural societies, particularly those found throughout, you know, Africa and the Middle East, where honor killings are still carried out to this day. And a lot of the honor killings that occur, particularly in the West, are largely migrant communities as well, carrying those beliefs over.
Expatriates, yeah.
Exactly. And some of these films do make me wonder where the world is headed. As on the one hand, honor and traditional values should be carried forward. I do believe that. But the expense afforded to them being upheld is not always balanced. And as societies, we shouldn't necessarily have to accept everything modern as being right and progressive. Just because it's new doesn't mean it is better. And that we should strive to maintain core values. But I do believe that at times, if your child is perceived as a lost cause by you or others, that the message in this film is live and let live. That you don't necessarily need to hunt them down and kill them. That the dishonor is not necessarily that great. And that perhaps the dishonor of killing someone needs to be elevated to a higher level so that it in itself is not as prevalent. And you could argue that that is something that's happened in other cultures where sort of murder is considered to be the most heinous of crimes against another person. However, at a purely psychological level, I guess this sort of looks at particularly when you're killing people of dishonor or different sexual biases or race and all this sort of thing. It's almost perceived as killing the weak or the cancerous parts of society, particularly for more traditional societies. And I guess it's a basic form of preventing it spreading. You know, if you kill the problem, then the problem ceases to exist. And
yeah.
I guess in that way, our programming as humans really isn't that different to any other organism. You know, if a part no longer serves a function or it's not beneficial going forward, as you could argue some of these issues may well be, whether it's right or wrong, then essentially we're still going to execute this most basic of functions in order to ensure our survival.
Yeah.
We see that as a cultural traditional context now, but if you strip away all the social levels, it still serves a very primitive function to actually ensure our survival.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So on that note, Sabe, let's wrap this film up. So Power of the Color Hill is a sublime anthology of four short story films directed by four prominent directors of Tamil South Indian film industry. It presents a critical social commentary described as a societal anthology with magnificent performances by an array of actors. It's fastidiously crafted from script to screen with accompanying music and editing to match its ferocity. Pavakar the Hell gives us an overview of the LGBTQI community, caste, gender violence, and honor killings. The film doesn't preach or propose a solution to the themes, but visually showcases the flaws inherent in society and how these flaws are significantly affecting the lives of its citizens. And for this reason, I give Pavakar the Hill a 8 out of 10.
I think you've summarized that film beautifully. Yeah, I don't think all the acting or anything was particularly exemplary across this film. There were certainly some standout ones. But I think for the fact that it covers the topics you just mentioned and does so, by and large, exceptionally well and focuses on things at a level and a social construct that we really don't see very often, and it really hones in on it, I think this little anthology was exceptionally well executed.
Yeah.
And so just from a content point of view, more than anything else, I'm going to give this film a 7.3.
Excellent.
And so with that, that's all from us, folks. So we hope you've enjoyed yet another episode from us. So remember to like, follow, and subscribe to our show on your favorite listening platform. And also check us out and follow us on Facebook or Instagram to get a sneak peeks at upcoming episodes, as well as some bonus content. And remember, if you enjoy our show, please remember to let your friends and family and colleagues know for their enjoyment also. So until next week then, goodbye.
Goodbye, everybody, and see you guys next week.